Case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Payton against New York and Riddick against New York. I think you may proceed when you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. These cases are before you on re-argument. They are appeals from the New York Court of Appeals, which by a vote of 4-3 sustained the constitutionality of New York's arrest statutes, which allow, even in the absence of exigent circumstances, a warrantless entry into the home for the purposes of arrest. So briefly state the facts, which I think in both cases are manifestations of the operation of the statute that in real terms demonstrate the importance of the warrant requirement, which I think this Court will require and should require. In the Payton case, you had a situation where on January 12th, 1970, there was a homicide in the course of a robbery on an Upper East Side gas station in New York City. 2 days later, the police, the investigating police, obtained information as to who they could believe with probable cause may have committed the crime. That information led them that day to go to premises, to have the premises pointed out to them, and to do nothing. To spend the rest of the afternoon, the entire evening, until 7:30 the next morning, when in a substantially large group of detectives, they went to the premises, an apartment on the fifth floor of a building in the South Bronx, in Manhattan, and after trying to force the door open and unable to do so, called for assistance, which arrived a half hour later, and with the use of crowbars, the door was forced open. Once the police entered the premises and they saw that Mr. Payton was not even there, they proceeded to ransack the apartment, seize a number of items, which all of which were suppressed by the trial court on consent of the prosecution, except for a .30-caliber cartridge that was found in plain view on top of a stereo set. The lower courts and the majority of the New York Court of Appeals, finding that the police were lawfully in the premises, since they did not need a warrant, could have seized what they saw in plain view. The Riddick case is another more striking, in some respects, example of the essentiality of a warrant requirement. In Riddick, the crime was committed 4 years prior to the arrest. The police had a probable cause and could have known and could have gotten Mr. Riddick a long time before they went to his apartment. They waited 2 months before they decided to arrest him in his apartment without a warrant, even though they knew his address. They went in. His three-year-old son entered the door. They entered. Mr. Riddick was sitting in his bed with some underwear on, but naked to the waist, and he was arrested. I think the entries in both of these cases are cardinal examples why, as I understand, where this Court has gone so far with respect to warrants, a warrant requirement should and must be imposed with respect to entries in non-exigent circumstances into private premises.
Well, if the police had had a warrant, that wouldn't have prevented them from arresting the latter petitioner in his underwear, would it?
No, Mr. Chester. They didn't arrest him in his underwear. They let him get dressed to leave. The reason I emphasize factually, underwear, we're talking about the home, and this is the heart of privacy. And in order to enter a home and to seize citizens in that context, I think, as I understand the warrant requirement, it has always been to ensure that a magistrate has determined that before that type of entry is made, the probable cause determination should be made by someone other than the police officer who has to make subjective judgments that are not always correct. In each case,
same argument
each of these
if this
cases,
were a motel. You would make the same argument if this were a motel?
Oh, yes, I would, Mr. S. Blackman, depending on the expectation of privacy that the residents of that motel room would have.
So that the word, quote, home, quote, doesn't have any particular magic in it?
I think that the court has said quite clearly that the Fourth Amendment protects people, not places, but people in the context of where their expectation of privacy is at the highest. And we would draw no distinction with respect to motels and homes, but the actual residence, and I think a motel room can be a home for the time the person is there, but there would be no distinction.
In each of these cases, the petitioner, by that is both Peyton and Riddick, were arrested in their, respectively, in their own residences, were they?
No, Mr. Peyton was not, he turned himself in. He was not home.
Oh, that's right.
When the,
but in any event, the entry was into the residence of each.
Yes.
Of Peyton and Riddick as well.
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Stewart.
And in each case, the residence was what, an apartment
in
New York City?
Peyton, it was a multiple tenement, a multiple dwelling tenement, fifth floor, apartment 5A. I've not seen the premises, but I think it's a typical New York, Manhattan tenement. In Riddick, it was a two-family private house in Queens.
Half a house.
Half a house. The majority below approached the case along the lines that an entry to arrest was less intrusive than an entry to search. That was its first premise. Its second premise was that an arrest in the home is less embarrassing than an arrest in public, and therefore this court's concern on Watson was even less forceful. For the reasons I'll state, I disagree with both. And again, the Court of Appeals thought that the common law was very one-sided in terms of trying to ascertain the intent of the framers, that it was one-sided, that the common law allowed entries. I think in our briefs extensively, we come to quite an opposite conclusion. So we think these assumptions were wrong, erroneous. I think it's noteworthy that since the opinion of the Court of Appeals in this case, a number of courts, high appellate courts, have refused to follow it. I think because it's a bitter pill for a lot of courts to follow, a warrantless entry of these kind. In the Eighth Circuit has just recently, in the Hull case, which is in our supplemental brief, refused to allow warrantless entries, and the high courts of Wisconsin and Pennsylvania also refused to follow the Peyton case, as decided by the majority. There's some significance, I think, in at least the sensitivity of a number of courts, both state and federal, to the issue. Our basic line, basic view, is that if one thing is clear about this court's decisions, it is that physical entry of the home is the chief evil against which the Fourth Amendment stands. And that's what this case is about. And the arrest warrant provides protection, at the very least, against that type of entry without a magistrate's determination that on the facts known to the officer, there is probable cause to believe the defendant has committed a crime. I think for us, the logical starting point of our argument has to be the plurality opinion in the Coolidge case, where the court said that the notion of a warrantless entry to arrest was per se at odds, unreasonable, in line of the court's decisions, and that absent well-defined exigent circumstances, there could be no warrantless entry. And further, in the Coolidge case, the court said that Warden versus Hayden, which has come to be known as a, quote, hot pursuit type case, stands by at least negative implication that an arrest warrant is required. These two statements of the plurality in Coolidge have led most, if not all, but a substantial and predominant number of courts to read the language in Coolidge to come to a conclusion quite opposite that reached by the majority below.
And we think these courts have come to what conclusion?
Quite opposite than that of the Court
which
of Appeals.
What?
Which is that a warrant is required.
What kind of a warrant?
That, I think, Mr. Justice White, is a little more difficult question than the issue
well,
of whether
a
warrant.
What the, I didn't know if you'd argue it. What are those cases
most
concluded about?
Most courts have held an arrest warrant. The Ninth Circuit in the United States versus Prescott has said we don't care what you call it as long as it has two things. It requires a determination by the magistrate as to entry of premises as well as probable cause for the crime. But most courts either gloss over what type of warrant or specifically say an arrest warrant. The Second Circuit, which is
just a probable cause to believe that this particular person committed a crime.
Yes.
Not that he's in the house.
Not that he's in the house. That is a determination when it's an arrest warrant, that when the warrant is being executed by
does
the
any court. Does any court that you know of require a search warrant?
The Ninth Circuit requires a warrant that requires the magistrate to do both. A number of other cases.
Which is to do both what? The probable cause to
rule a search warrant.
To enter the house because there's probable cause to believe
right.
The man is there.
Yes.
Is that your position?
My position is that maximally a search warrant would make the most sense in terms of
what about minimally?
Minimally, an arrest warrant plus reasonable cause when that warrant is executed by the officer to believe the defendant is in the premises.
So you're minimally the Ninth Circuit position?
No, the Ninth Circuit would go a little bit more, and I would be glad to have it. But I would take the position that I think at least was touched upon in this court's opinion in the Dahlia case.
In which case?
Dahlia of the United States, the surreptitious entry case, where Mr. Justice Powell, writing for the court, specifically noted that an arrest warrant, first of all, was not a useless document. Secondly, that a magistrate cannot always focus on every aspect of the privacy intrusion, but that the important thing is that there's an arrest warrant in the officer's hand. Now, as far as I see it, in a case such as this, where no warrant at all is required as a predicate for entry, at the very least, the Fourth Amendment should require and does require an arrest warrant.
Mr. Hallstein, are there some courts that say that all you need is an arrest warrant, or that there's a court that says you need only probable cause to enter the house. You don't need a warrant at all.
Right.
But don't some of those courts say at the time that you enter the house, you must have probable cause not only to arrest, but to believe the man is in the house?
I think yes. I think there is a, I don't recall if they specifically talk about the second aspect, but I would say it would be a fair guess that even a court such as I think the Seventh Circuit, which does not require a warrant, would say that even though you're going in with probable cause on the crime, you also have to believe the fellow is in the premises.
Is that what the New York courts held here?
The New York, that issue did not come up in terms of these cases.
The light was on in there at the radio or something.
Yes. So I would.
So they did have reason to believe there was somebody in there.
Yes, Mr. Justice.
In each of these cases, you concede that there was probable cause?
For the crime.
Yes, and therefore that an arrest warrant could have properly issued?
Yes, I do, Mr. Stewart. I think the information at both offices.
What about the probable cause to believe that somebody is on that the defendant is on the premises?
I think that the officers, had they gotten a warrant, would have, if it was an arrest warrant, would have had probable cause in both cases to execute that warrant. And I think
so that the narrow issue here is whether you need some kind of a warrant.
Yes. That's
Mr. Heller, Mr. Hallstein, earlier in your argument, you placed great stress on the using Coolidge versus New Hampshire, Justice Stewart's opinion, as a starting point. I take it Justice Harlan's concurring opinion was necessary to make that a majority opinion.
Yes.
And as I read his opinion, he starts out saying, from the several opinions that have been filed in this case, it is apparent that the law of search and seizure is due for an overhauling. Then he goes on and he says, I would begin this process of reevaluation by overruling Mapp against Ohio and Kerr against California. Now, I take it if one were to follow Justice Harlan's view, you wouldn't have much of a case.
I guess it would depend upon the composition of the court at the current time. First of all, Ms. Justice Rehnquist, I think that, and I don't presume to speak for Mr. Justice Harlan, that the considerations which he spoke to in those cases were his views of federalism and the role of the Fourth Amendment, and I know that you, for one, do share perhaps with respect to Mapp, at least that view. But I think also that Mr. Justice Harlan was extremely sensitive, as he said in Jones, two forcible entries into the home to make an arrest and said that a grave constitutional question was presented by that issue, which is the issue we have here. The approach which the Court of Appeals below took, the majority opinion by Judge Jones, really, I think, denigrated or underestimated tremendously the nature of an arrest entry. I mean, to be able for the court to be able to say that an arrest entry was less intrusive than a search entry just doesn't square factually with what we know about arrest entries or, in fact, the facts of this case. First of all, when police enter a dwelling, as they did in these cases, they're affecting the privacy of all the people who are there. They may be more than just a defendant. But the manner of the entry is not designed to safeguard the privacy interest and minimize it. We have in our brief cited manuals, standard operating manuals, of what police are supposed to do when they go into a premises to arrest for a felony. They're to protect themselves. They're to fan out, engage in protective sweeps. That's pretty intrusive and can be very often much more intrusive than a search, which, if you find the item or items that are specified in the search warrant, can be very unobtrusive. The entire premises are open to scrutiny. Items that people hold dear to them, that are private, that have nothing to do with whatever they're being sought for or can be seen by officers. A search incident to an arrest can be very intrusive. On the other hand, a search can be minimal. There was nothing minimal about the entries in these two cases.
Well, in these two cases, even if the state is correct, that wouldn't lead to a lot of intensive, indiscriminate searching. The search incident to the arrest would be limited by the contours delineated in the Schimel case.
Yes, Schimel.
And anything else would just be subject to the plain view.
That's right, Mr. Chairman.
Is that right?
But I think what's important is the point that
we don't have here, even if the threat is, if the state is correct, a threat of an intensive search throughout the house.
Well, you have that. I think that's the point that Chief Judge Cook was trying to make in his dissent, and I think there is some value in it. He said if the officers here had had an arrest warrant, they would have known in Peyton that they were going to arrest Peyton.
Right.
They would not have.
And that was their only purpose.
Right.
Any search would be limited to
the limitations of
Schimel, plus they could have seized anything in plain view.
That's correct.
If the state is correct. Period.
Yes.
Isn't that right?
That's correct. But I think it was sort of a psychological point that the Chief Judge was making, and that is the warrant itself has the value of limiting, telling the officer a directive that when you have this fellow, you have probable cause to believe he's committed a crime, you go and arrest him, that's all you're supposed to be doing. And we're not going to leave it to the, you know, suppression at a trial to take care of everything else you're ransacked the place for. That, I think, was the point.
Well, plain view doctrine would be an exception to all of that.
Yes, yes.
If while they're standing inside the door and the arrestee says, let me get my clothes on, they see a pistol or whatever, they can take that, of course, can't they?
Yes, I'm not saying
if they're lawfully there.
If they're lawfully there. Our position is that in this case, they were not lawfully there without a warrant. And as I stated earlier, as I see it, the minimum requirement is for an arrest warrant. If what this court, albeit a plurality or even a majority in the Dahlia case, have given meaning to an arrest warrant, then that is the kind of warrant that should be required and is required with respect to arrest entries.
How about arresting somebody in a third person's home?
There, I think, at least in terms of the way scholarly discussion has gone, in some circuits, such as the Third Circuit, there is a greater concern that in that situation particularly, perhaps only a search warrant will do the job because of the concerns that there the magistrate is not even focusing on the person whose premises it is. I don't think this court has to get into that in this case. These two cases involve arrest entries, premises.
Would the magistrate ordinarily focus on whose home other than his own the person might be in?
Not in an arrest warrant context. He would if he were required to get a search warrant.
The you'd be satisfied with an arrest warrant even to support the search, the breaking in of the home of John Smith, because the officers suspected that the object of the warrant might be there?
Some courts have so held.
More likely Mary Smith.
Some courts have so held that, again, and I think the logic for it would be that it still requires, once you have the valid arrest warrant, the judgment left to the officer under an arrest warrant that the person is in the premises sought must be based upon probable cause. I don't think that's an optimal solution. I'm going to make myself clear. But for the purposes of this case and the issues presented, I don't think I've got to convince you that you need go further. I should point out that this court has amended Rule 41 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure to provide for search warrants, not arrest warrants, when persons are being sought, without limiting it to third-person premises. I can only say that there's logic to that amendment. It would be wrong for me to say anything other than that. But furthermore, that if the court had a desire to harmonize Rule 41, which at least you at times said implemented Fourth Amendment concerns, then the most sensible reconciliation of this difficult issue would be to require a search warrant, so that Rule 41 would totally conform with what the Fourth Amendment requires. But I do not think it is necessary for this case. The prosecution, my adversary, Mr. Zimroff, talks a great deal about the burdens to police if you impose either type of requirement. I know that in the warrant context, you've heard that argument many times, and you rejected it many times. And you rejected it many times because you placed the importance of that warrant requirement in our constitutional scheme at a very high level. And when you combine that with the home premises, privacy of the home, I think the prosecution should have an insurmountable burden in terms of policy arguments. If we start with the premise that we're talking about non-exigent circumstances, then I can see no weight at all to Mr. Zimroff's argument that a warrant requirement imposed by this court would be a burden to any legitimate concern of police officers. Because if it's not exigent, circumstances not exigent, then the police have time to do a number of things. And I think these two cases pointed out. In Riddick, they had an awful lot of time to take a slight detour and get an arrest warrant.
But in our Watson decision, certainly we didn't decide that on the basis that it would be just a terrible burden on the police to go get a warrant to arrest a man in a public place. We went on the tradition that it had always been done that way, and that's what the Constitution must have meant.
I think in Watson you felt yourself freer to do it based on the fairly one-sided, almost exclusively so, history of the common law with respect to arrest entries. That is not so with respect to going into homes to make arrests. I think that at the very least, and I think the court in Miller v. United States, a long time ago, 1957, pointed out that the law with respect to arrest entries into the home was not letter clear.
Miller was a statutory case.
Yes, that was Section 3109. But in a footnote, Mr. Justice Brennan, writing for the court, acknowledged, first of all, he pointed to Judge Prettyman's opinion in the Aquino case, where Judge Prettyman, I think, makes a very substantial brief that the common law was very one-sided our way. And if I had to argue that, I would. But I don't think that what was available to the court in Watson, the clarity of the common law going the other way, can possibly be available here, and it's not.
Don't you think it's quite important that under Section 3109, Congress had given specific instructions to federal officers as to the precise, very precise manner in which the warrant was to be executed?
That was with respect to knock and announce. And
well, more than that.
Not
announce their purpose and their
purpose
authority
and yes.
Their identity.
Yes, Mr.
But I think the opinion said a few more words would have sufficed. They announced part of what the statute required, but not all, if I recall it correctly.
Oh, I think the court was quite clear in Miller that that was a very important intendment by Congress in 3109. But what was not before the court
in Miller... Congress had expanded what the Constitution required.
Well, the court did not hold in Miller, as I understand it, Mr. Chief Justice, that it was construing the Constitution in terms of knock and announce.
I say Congress had expanded what the Constitution required, and the officers had not met that expanded requirement.
That may well be. But that had nothing to do with the issue in this case, in the sense that the question of being able to enter without a warrant was not presented. The prosecution, in closing out its brief, I don't think that the arguments of a rush to get the warrant, if we're not talking about exigent circumstances, can be very substantial, talks about such things as the rubber stamp, that if you hold a warrant is required for felony arrest within the home, in this case, the magistrate's going to begin to rubber stamp these things. I think that is entirely out of sync. It's not synchronized with what this court feels about the role of magistrates and the importance of the independent judgment of the magistrate. Another argument that the prosecution makes is that if you require a warrant, I call it the irrevocable arrest of the innocent argument, which Mrs. Zimroth puts forth, that once a warrant is issued, it must be executed. That if an officer gets a warrant, says you are directed to bring to the court this fellow, he must do so. But that's not true. It's not true under New York law. It's not true under any law that I know. That if an officer gets information that undercuts the basis for that warrant, he's not obligated to go and arrest an innocent man. There are two arguments that the prosecution makes.
He's still authorized to arrest the man.
He's authorized.
Whom he now thinks is...
Yes, but he doesn't have to do it. He can cancel it.
It's an authorization, not a command.
Yes.
That's your point.
It's a process. The last two arguments which Mrs. Zimroth makes is that if you require a warrant, you're going to reduce the scope of suppression hearings because there'll be less for us defense lawyers to do. And tied to that is the reduction of possible damage suits against officers because they now have warrants. I should have thought of those arguments. I'm sorry I didn't in my brief. But those seem to me exactly the kinds of arguments that should come as a logical consequence of the warrant requirement and should be a desirable outcome. Why should we have to have extensive suppression hearings based on who did what and who knew what if there's a warrant that a magistrate's passed upon? More importantly, why should police have to be at their peril with respect to making these judgments?
Wouldn't it just transfer all the focus of the suppression hearing from the grounds for the warrant to whether or not there were probable cause to enter the home, though?
It's been my experience that hearings which are directed to controverting warrants, my experience has been greater in the search warrant area, are much more limited. Namely, they really go to whether there's perjury in the underlying affidavits. They do not rehash all of the factual determinations which were presented to the magistrate, unless there's a, I think this court is so held.
Well, Aguilar, and
Aguilar.
More than that.
But I think these are policy arguments which simply do not support the source from which they come, is my only point. That being the case, I'd say none of the policy arguments are worth this court declining to follow the logic of its prior decisions and to hold that a warrant is required in non-exigent circumstances for an arrest in the home.
Mr. Zimroth?
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. Mr. Hellestein is asking this court to, in a very drastic manner, change the balance of accommodating interests that have been with us from the earliest of recorded history on this subject until relatively recently. The accepted manner in which the lawfulness of an entry into a home to make an arrest for a felony was quite clear, and that is that the officers brought the defendant into custody and then the judicial system mobilized in a very substantial manner to test two things. First, the factual predicate for the arrest, and second, the manner of execution of the arrest. This was a judgment of people who were very sensitive to the needs of privacy. In fact, these very same people created the protections that subsequently became the protections of the Fourth Amendment with respect to search warrants. In fact, this system that I have outlined, if I may borrow the words of Mr. Justice Powell in the Gersten against Butte case, where he said, there are indications that the framers of the Bill of Rights regarded it, meaning this system that I've just outlined, as the model of a reasonable seizure under the Fourth Amendment. Mr. Hellestein, I think, is simply incorrect when he says that there was a substantial dispute about this prior to the adoption of the Fourth Amendment. There were many disputes about the manner in which the lawfulness of arrests were to be tested, but those disputes were about the standards to be applied in the litigation after the defendant was brought into custody, and not disputes about whether or not there should be a magistrate interposed in the ongoing system of the ongoing investigation. The common law authorities and the framers of the Fourth Amendment recognized that this was an accommodation of competing interests. It was a substantial protection against illegal arrests in the home and elsewhere. There was an additional protection of against illegal arrests in the home by the requirement that the officers knock and announce their authority, as Mr. Chief Justice mentioned earlier, which is now the law in most states, or many states, by statute. And the purpose was to minimize the need for force, to give the people inside the ability to submit peaceably to the authority of the officer. But again, these standards were tested in the litigation after the defendant or the suspect was brought into custody. The entire burden, I think, of Mr. Hellestein's argument is that we have a search warrant requirement, and therefore we must have an arrest warrant requirement. And if I may summarize the many reasons I think that those two powers and warrants are vastly different before I get into the argument. In the first place, the community's interests are vastly different in the two kinds of powers. The effect on the law enforcement functions are vastly different. And thirdly, the search power is much more extensive and more intrusive than the arrest power, and the need for a warrant requirement is much greater. These are the very reasons why the two powers have been treated differently for so much of our history. And Mr. Hellestein says that there will be no burden on law enforcement if you interpose a magistrate before the arrest. This court has examined that argument twice relatively recently, once in Gersten against Pugh, where Mr. Justice Powell called this an intolerable handicap for legitimate law enforcement. That characterization was repeated in Watson, both by the majority and then by Mr. Justice Powell in concurrence again, where he said that the interposition of a magistrate would, quote, severely hamper effective law enforcement. And in fact, it would severely hamper effective law enforcement. Any warrant requirement will have to be seen from the perspective of the police officers who are going to have to live with this requirement. Just as an example, where Mr. Hellestein criticizes the police in Peyton for not getting a warrant after the afternoon of January the 14th. He says that they knew the name of the defendant and that they knew they looked at his building. And he says they did nothing. He says they did nothing after that until the next morning. Well, that's simply untrue. What they were doing was further investigation, and it's the kind of investigation that should be fostered by this court, and the police should not be diverted from that kind of investigation in order to go get a warrant, which will be a very time-consuming process. In fact, what they were doing was trying to put together a photo array so that they could know what the defendant looked like. And also, what they were doing is to try to find out where the defendant was. Knowing where the defendant's apartment is very different from knowing where the defendant is. Here we have a defendant who 2 days earlier shot and killed a manager of a gas station, and on that same night he goes to his friend and admits to the friend that he did it, and also tells the friend that he's going, quote, somewhere. This is the same defendant who must have known that two, perhaps three people in the gas station knew this defendant. It seems to me knowing the defendant's address in a circumstance like that is, as I say, very different from knowing where he is at any particular moment. And it also seems to me that that is exactly the kind of situation in which the police should be encouraged to do further investigation and should not be diverted from that investigation by the very time-consuming process in which a warrant would be.
How long did it take to get a warrant to meet up?
Mr. Justice Marshall, in this particular case, since there was no warrant requirement, there's nothing in the record. However, in a case in the...
But since you and I both know Manhattan, I wonder...
I think it would take a very substantial amount of time. Can I go through for you what steps the police would have to do to get a warrant so you can see how substantial it would be? The first thing the police would have to do, from the moment they decide, well, now is the time we have to get a warrant, is they would have to gather together all the facts. Now, in this particular investigation, there were many police officers who were doing this investigation, not just one. They would have to gather those facts and put them into some presentable form to present to a prosecutor, not to a judge, but first to a prosecutor. And the reason for that is that under New York law, as is true in some other states, you cannot get an arrest warrant until you initiate a criminal prosecution. That is not a police decision, that is a prosecutorial decision. So you have to take all of those facts and you have to go down to the prosecutor's office. Now, I have personally been involved in questioning police officers about their investigations. It is not a process which any responsible prosecutor would just slough off, because it is the initiation of a criminal prosecution that is at stake. It is, and if the more complicated the investigation, the more complicated the questioning of the prosecutor.
Did he do all of this before he broke in the man's door?
Your Honor, he didn't.
Did he do all of this before he got the crowbars and tore the man's door off?
No, sir, he did not. There was no warrant requirement.
Yeah, but shouldn't he have?
No, sir, he should not have, because if...
He shouldn't have thought over very carefully as to whether he had the right man or not.
Oh, no, no, of course. He should have thought very carefully whether he had the right man.
But after that, couldn't he have just dropped by the magistrate's office?
Absolutely not. He cannot drop by the magistrate's office. He has to first drop by the prosecutor's office and be
well,
grilled.
Did he drop by the prosecutor's office before he tore the man's door down?
No, sir.
So he tore the man's door down without going by the, not only without getting a warrant, but he don't even have to check with the prosecutors to tear the man's door down.
Under the laws that exist.
Is that your theory of the law in New York?
Absolutely it is, yes. After he goes to the prosecutor's office, in order to get a warrant, there's still much more that has to be. Then, at that time, you first get into the problem.
May I just be sure I follow your argument here? Are you saying, in substance, that there are a good many cases in which police officers think they have probable cause, but the prosecutor says there isn't enough here to justify a warrant?
No, sir. There are cases in which the prosecutor would say you have probable cause, but I'm not going to authorize the initiation of a criminal prosecution because I don't think we have enough to convict.
Well, then in those cases, would it be appropriate for the police officer to go out and arrest him?
Yes, it might. It might because, for example, one reason might be that a typical situation is if there's been a photo array, as there was in this case. We know as prosecutors that photo arrays, although they may amount to probable cause, are not the most reliable in terms of convincing a jury. The police may have to get the defendant into custody first so that they can have a lineup. And once they have a lineup, and if the defendant picks the complainants pick the defendant out of the lineup, well, then you obviously have a much stronger case. So all I'm suggesting is that this warrant process is not a 1-2-3 affair. It's a very time-consuming situation.
Well, I know that you finished. You said it's a several-step process, and I think you've just given us the first step. You go to the prosecutor,
right?
And assume you persuade the prosecutor that there's enough
okay, then you have
for
to
him to initiate a criminal prosecution. Then what?
Well, then you have all of the paperwork that's dependent upon filing the case in court. And if you're lucky, the court will be open at that time. You can't get the...
And this is a matter of New York law. As a matter of New York law, all of this has to precede the issuance of an arrest warrant.
Yes, sir.
That's your point?
Yes, sir. You can't
well,
have an arrest...
Well, constitutionally it doesn't. It's
no.
just a matter of New York law.
Yes,
York
but...
Practice and procedure.
It's a matter of the New York law, which says that you can't get an arrest warrant until you have a criminal action that's begun. That's
initiated.
True. Initiated.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
So then the prosecutor files the...
Now, I don't know how many other states have that, but I know that New York is not alone in that.
No. So he files an information. New York does not require a grand jury indictment, does it?
Ultimately, for a felony, yes. There has to be...
But for the purposes of a search warrant, it can be just an information?
For an arrest warrant, yes.
I mean an arrest warrant?
Yes.
And then an information is filed. Then what happens?
Well, then there'll be a grand... Then the case will go to the grand jury. Oh, you mean in terms of...
an arrest warrant.
It's getting an arrest warrant. You go into court, you have to docket the case, and then you have to wait your turn on the calendar to go before a judge. The statute then says
who's
that the judge...
Who's you now who has to wait
the prosecutor
turn?
And the police.
Prosecutor or the policeman.
Well, it'll be the prosecutor probably and the policeman.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go into court, and if the judge, who by the way is doing a lot of other things at that time, will see you... He then has the well. Now he has the option to question the police officer or question the basis. Prior to this criminal procedure law, there was some suggestion in the law that he was required to go beyond just what was before him on papers and question the police officer. And then, if he was satisfied that there was probable cause, he would issue the warrant.
And only a judge can issue a warrant in the state of New York.
But,
do you have magistrates or?
Well, the magistrates are the criminal court judges.
Period. There are no other magistrates. Is that
in New York City, I'm pretty sure that's true. I don't.
You're
I'm not positive about upstate.
You're telling me there are no magistrates in New York City.
I'm saying that the magistrates are the criminal court judges, which are the.
And only they.
Aren't there magistrates holding magistrates' courts?
Those courts have been abolished, and now it's the.
But it's the same man as now a judge?
Yes, sir. Same man is now a judge.
Well, Mr. Zimroth, you know, the Second Circuit doesn't seem to be too worried about the impact of such a constitutional holding on police practices.
No, on the FBI and on the FBI and on the DEA.
Oh, I know, but they know that on habeas corpus they're going to be facing the same issue out of the New York courts, and I suppose they're not going to say that it's unconstitutional. For federal marshals or for the FBI to arrest without a warrant, and yet it's all right for a state officer.
I can't account for their decision except to suggest that it's...
And certainly the people who've joined in those opinions in the Second Circuit have been New York lawyers.
But their experiences are really with a different system, Your Honor. I was an assistant United States attorney. Now I'm a state prosecutor. It's a world of difference. I mean, the resources are much different.
Have the Second Circuit or the federal courts applied the Second Circuit rule in federal habeas corpus proceedings?
No, I'm not aware of any. I'm not aware of any decision. And also, my colleague points out to me that I think that they would be foreclosed from applying this rule in federal habeas corpus
Stone.
Under Stone against Powell.
Yes.
So.
Very quick.
So it's a very different...
Meanwhile, while all these things are going on, what's happening out at the ranch, as it were?
That's exactly the problem.
What is happening?
Well, what could be happening is that the defendant could be escaping.
I suppose they could get four or five policemen and surround the house, couldn't they?
They could do that, but on the other hand, it seems to me... it would be very wrong for this court to require that sort of conduct. It's very dangerous.
I was just asking you what they would do if
what they would do?
The man from getting out.
Realistically, I think
if he tries to walk out of the house, they can of course arrest him. I take it.
Yeah, but what that would require is a stakeout, and I think that's a very dangerous sort of thing. Whether they would do it, I don't know. I mean, I suppose in some cases they would, and in other cases. In other cases, they would
depend on the severity of the crime, I suppose,
and the manpower of the of that particular squad. That's another problem with this arrest warrant requirement, is that it's going to be applied to in the neighborhood of 22,000 police departments throughout the United States, and also in an infinite variety of investigations, so that it really will be unpredictable. Any particular case would be unpredictable.
In this case, could he have gotten it in 18 hours?
Could he have gotten the warrant in 18 hours? I assume so.
Well, why didn't he?
Factually, the reason he...
Noon on one day, and he broke in his place at 7:30 the next day.
Facts were not given to him on noon on one day. They knew at noon on the day before was they had one person saying that he recognized the man who did the job.
Didn't he take him to the place and show him the building?
That was much later.
Much?
Yes, sir.
How much later?
That was well into the afternoon and into the evening.
Yeah, in a minute, you're going to be where you could get it.
Excuse me?
In a minute, you're going to, if a guy is as expeditious as he was, he could have gotten the warrant.
The issue isn't really...
The difference is very simple. With the warrant, the man keeps his door. And his privacy.
Not necessarily.
Without the warrant, he loses his door.
Not necessarily. I mean, the warrant does not protect the privacy in that manner, because you can bust down the door with a warrant, too. What happened, if the police had a warrant in this case, they would have busted down the door exactly the same way, because they saw a light underneath
but they
the...
They might not have gotten the warrant. They might not have been able to convince the magistrate that they were entitled to it. Wouldn't he have kept his door there?
Well, if you're saying that they wouldn't have gone to arrest this man, obviously then they wouldn't have broken down his door. That's true. I don't think that it's fair to suggest, however, that the warrant requirement will somehow be a quantum leap in additional protection than what the residents already have. I mean, you have to, it seems to me, be concerned with the fact that you're talking about thousands and thousands of cases and the possibility of trivializing the warrant process.
Mr. Zimroth, do either of the respondents challenge the probable cause for arrest in this case?
No, sir. Nor, I heard Mr. Hellerstein say, the probable cause to believe that the defendant was in the particular location, which is, by the way, a requirement under state law. By statute.
Even though it's his own residence?
You need...
I can understand that the requirement of probable cause to believe that he's somewhere else.
No, sir.
Does the state law require probable cause to believe that he's in his own home?
Absolutely. In some ways, I think, is one of my points. It's more protective than a warrant requirement would be.
Well, except that the warrant requirement requires a disinterested third person to evaluate probable cause. That's the protection.
To believe that the defendant committed the crime, but not probable cause to believe that the defendant is in a particular location, which is required under state law, which is, as I say, more protective than the warrant requirement would be, assuming it's an arrest warrant requirement, which, by the way, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, Mr. Justice Rehnquist or Mr. Justice White, I forgot who asked this question. Every court that I'm aware of that has held that there needs to be a warrant requirement has said there has to be only an arrest warrant requirement. The Prescott case, which is a Ninth Circuit case that Mr. Hellerstein refers to, was a case of an entry into a third party's residence, although I do concede that there is a dictum in that case which suggests that the Ninth Circuit would require a full-blown search warrant.
The warrant must describe the place to be searched
to
be seized, which in this case is a person.
I agree. It's strong dictum, but it is dictum. I mean, that particular entry, I think, was into the girlfriend's house of the defendant. It wasn't the defendant's apartment or house in that case.
Well, what do you conceive to be the practical difference, since you want to talk practicalities, between the jurisprudential approach on persons and things? You say historically you don't need a warrant to enter a house to make an arrest, but
I take it because, I guess you're going to say, because people are so mobile and can escape.
Well, it's not only
but how about things?
It's not
they're
only
just they can leave the house with a person.
It's not only that the people are mobile and can escape, but in most or many situations where you're talking about arrests, it's fair to suppose that the defendant or the suspect knows of the police interest before the police, at the very same time that the police are gathering their evidence. It's fair to suppose that the defendant knows of the police interest. It makes it a very volatile situation, which is very different from the search warrant situation. If you take eavesdropping, for example, as the archetypical search warrant situation, the subject.
Yes, but that would lead to say that you wouldn't need a warrant to go in the house to get a gun. The fellow, you think the gun is in the house, you can get a search warrant. You have probable cause, but you need the warrant. Although the man that you suspect could easily leave the house with a gun.
I'm not suggesting...
You just don't have probable cause to arrest him yet. You have probable cause to believe the gun's in the house, though.
I'm not suggesting that there won't be any situations in which you search that will be volatile. Obviously, there will be some situations, but I'm talking about as a gross matter. And that's why the judgment was made. There's a second very important point, and that's the point of numbers. Take New York City, for example. In New York City last year, there were 107,000 felony arrests. In New York County, which is Manhattan, one of the five counties of New York City, there were 36,000 felony arrests. There were in the order of 600 search warrants issued in New York County last year.
So you suggest that even if there are a lot of cases when you think you might, a warrant might reasonably be required, you just say that you need a crude, broad rule that people can, a bright line of some kind.
Absolutely. I think this is a perfectly...
Do you know how many of those arrests were in public places, or do you know how many of them were under exigent circumstances?
No, you don't. But...
Wouldn't you guess that a large proportion were one or the other, or
well,
both?
Well, I do know that Mr. Hellestein has cited a study, we've cited the same study in our brief, that finds that fully half the felony arrests in urban centers in this country take place 2 hours or more after the commission of the crime. So that I think it's fair to say that the police officers will not necessarily know in advance where they're going to find the defendant. So those are the situations, at least that's the universe from which the police officers are going to have to go get a warrant, since they're not going to know in advance where they're going to find them.
Isn't part of the montage, or whatever you want to call it, argument, analogous to Mr. Justice Stewart's comment in the earlier case that perhaps the most logical thing to do in connection to the Fifth Amendment is to ask the suspect, did you do it or not? And if not, tell us where you were and so forth. It's logical, but the Fifth Amendment prohibits it. And there are lots of things in the Constitution that are prohibited by that perhaps if we were to re-examine them today, we wouldn't necessarily incorporate. By the same token,
Fourth Amendment, by its terms, talks about reasonableness.
Yes, but by the same token, it derives historical antecedents, and if there are a long chain of historical antecedents, perhaps you would say that logically one situation may not be too different from another, but it's been long established that you need probable cause to get a search warrant for a gun in a house, and that the contrary may be true of the U.S.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's both true, but I also, it's not only historical antecedents. I think there's a great logic to it. And the logic of the difference between the way that the two situations are treated is, as I've suggested, the arrest situation is much more volatile. Also, the community's interest in the two situations is very different. Obviously, it's very important for police officers to gather evidence to convict someone of a crime. But that interest, it seems to me, palls next to the interest of the community in getting a defendant in custody so that the civilizing processes of law can be brought to bear on his particular case, so guilt or innocence can be decided by a court. There is no... In my judgment, there is no law enforcement or community interest that is greater than that. And that's another reason why. And then there's a third reason why there's a, or maybe I'm up to the fourth or fifth reason why there's a big difference, and that is that the power to search is a much broader power. Evidence of a crime can be anything It can be anywhere, and it can be in anybody's custody, especially now after Warden v. Hayden and Zurcher. The need for a requirement, even independent of the finding of probable cause, to limit the scope of the search, to tell the police officer what he can look for and where, and also to tell the subjects of the search what can be looked for and where, is crucially important. And that's very different from the arrest power, which is by its nature very, very limited. It's obvious to everybody concerned. You don't need a warrant to tell police officers what the object is. It's one particular person, and what to do with that person is to bring them before a court. And those are some of the reasons for the historical difference, Mr. Justice Rehnquist. And unless there are any further questions, I'll make
a point in your supplementary brief that I suppose would lead to the consequence that even if we decide against you, our decision should be prospective only.
It should not apply to this particular case, yes.
Should not apply to these cases.
Yes.
Relying, as you do, upon a decision of the court late last term.
Among others. We made that same argument
in the original brief,
but we just updated it with DeFilippo. And
you haven't addressed yourself orally to that point at all.
No, sir, but what I can say about that is, Your Honor, that in 1970, when these officers made entry into this apartment, there was almost nothing that they could have seen around them that would have led them to believe that they should not follow the statute that they were following. That statute had been on the books for 100 years. It was not a dead letter. It was part of the living law of the state of New York. It was not a jarring exception. 30 out of 36 states that had legislated on this subject had precisely the same authorization. There wasn't a hint in anything in this court that sort of conduct was illegal in any way.
Well, there were hints from this court, weren't there, in 1970?
71. Yeah, that's Coolidge.
Well, how about Jones?
Jones was a nighttime entry. And the court was very specific.
When was Warden against Hayden decided?
Warden against Hayden was previous, but I think it's fair to say that it wasn't until... Wasn't previous?
Yes, it was previous.
But I think it's fair... Well, I think it's fair to say that it wasn't until your decision in Coolidge...
There were no hints.
That was a hint.
Yeah.
What
if New York law had said, what if a statute of New York had said, in this state, no warrants of any kind shall be required for any searches or seizures of any kind?
There's no law enforcement official in this country who would not tell a police officer, I don't care what that statute says, you better watch out. There's trouble ahead if you obey that statute. If these police officers had come to a group of law enforcement officials and professors of law and judges at that time and said, now, what should we do? Should we follow the statute? I think what those people would have said is, absolutely. That's the law.
Well, your employees, your officers of the state of New York, and that's the legislature of the state of New York. That's very natural advice to give. So would it have also, I guess, with my hypothetical statute?
No, sir. Not true. If for example, myself as a prosecutor, if a police officer came to me in that situation that you posited, I would say, probably I would say, don't follow the statute. But if I didn't say that, I would at least say, you follow it at your risk. I wouldn't have said that in 1970 in this situation, and I don't think anybody else would have said it either.
But it doesn't apply in this case because they didn't go to any official.
That's true.
Right?
Hellerstein, you have?
I have nothing further.
Well, very well. Thank you, gentlemen.
I have a question.
By all means.
Do you agree with him about how long it takes to get a warrant?
Oh, not at all.
I didn't think you did.
First of all, just to answer that, Mr. Zimoff is talking within the context of our existing statutory framework that says because we only give you warrants when you commence a prosecution, you have to see the prosecutor. But that's what this case is about, where police officers can get warrants without having to see the prosecutor, as they do in those jurisdictions where you can. That's a critical difference.
Very well. Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Board of Education of New York. Sure.